Hey guys, what's happening? Welcome back to the show from, you know, last week. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, we debunk war party lies about Iran and their nuclear program and the IAEA and the nuclear deal and the, you know how it is. Also, bad news. About the police state, for example. About, Iran stuff mostly. Not mostly. Somewhat. Yeah, I don't know. Israel lobby stuff. Oh, got some Syria, got some Korea for you. It's gonna be a show, you know, like usual. Alright, so Nali Kolhatkar. So Nali Kolhatkar, I hope is how you say it. She is going to be on the show to talk about her very important article that she wrote that I do not have in front of me, and I better get it here. It's about Yemen, and it ran at TruthDig. TruthDig, Yemen, Sonali. Let's see, I'll do it right there. Why are we ignoring the war in Yemen? Well, don't mean to. Would like to not ignore it, please. So here's to paying attention to the war in Yemen, which the LA Times is reporting as of last week, the United States is escalating participation in. What a disaster over there. So anyway, I'm going to let her tell you all about that. And also, Dr. Yosef Butt is going to be back on the show again today. He's an actual nuclear scientist, unlike a lot of the experts quoted in your fancy newspapers. So, I know he's got a bone to pick with, David Sanger at the New York Times. Unsurprisingly, David Sanger. Anyway, he's the George John of the New York Times. Or is that the other way around? They're both liars, you see. They deliberately tell lies. You know, they say things that aren't true so that people will believe things that aren't true because it's part of the agenda that they serve. You understand how that is? All right, good. Yeah, David Sanger, he's going to get nuked by Yosef Butt on the show today. And then also we're going to talk about Parchin. Parchin some more. Parchin. I heard Saddam Hussein has a giant human being-sized shredder. You know, like you would shred papers in? Only this one is really big for putting people in. Yeah, no. Well, this guy, Ahmed Chalabi, he knows a guy who swears it's true. And the Ayatollah gave him some money. So you know you can trust him. Anyway. Parchin. It's kind of like the aluminum tubes, right? Aluminum tubes! If you stop for a minute, you go, well, wait. What's so scary about an aluminum tube? What is this about aluminum tubes? Oh, you claim that Saddam bought aluminum tubes because then he was going to turn them into centrifuges and then he was going to enrich enough weapons-grade uranium with those centrifuges to make a nuclear bomb, huh? He was going to make a Manhattan Project in front of the eye in the sky and God and everybody, huh? With those aluminum tubes. But they never had to really explain all of that nonsense between the lines that is ridiculous on the face of it, if you examine it. Saddam Hussein was going to build his own little Sandia National Laboratory for making nukes, huh? Without anybody noticing, huh? Oh, yeah, no, you could have a centrifuge here and a centrifuge there. Spread all around the country. No. Anyway. Aluminum tubes became shorthand for Saddam Hussein is making nuclear weapons, I promise. Shorthand. Aluminum tubes. Aluminum tubes. Don't forget Saddam and his aluminum tubes. And by the end of the thing, you kind of forget what those words mean. They don't really mean aluminum tubes anymore. Now they mean Saddam Hussein's secret nuclear weapons program. Nobody had to prove anything. Hey, can't let the smoking gun be a mushroom cloud. You're buying that, right? This is too big of an emergency for me to have time to prove it to you, okay? Just trust me. Same kind of thing here. Parchin. Parchin, parchin, parchin. Nuclear tests. Nuclear tests. Anybody ever prove any of this? No. Does it make any sense at all? Nah, not really. Of course not. Does it have to? Maybe not. Maybe it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It just matters whether there's an endless fusillade. How about that? Of accusations against Iran. Iran nuclear scary. Iran nuclear scary. There, chant that with me 100 times till you believe it. Probably won't take that many. How about 10 times? The surge worked. Iran is scary. Believe what you're told. Anyway, so the thing about Yosef Butt is you tell him Iran's scary. He goes, oh, yeah, in what way? And then you go, well, nuclear. And he goes, oh, yeah, in what way? And you go, oh, I don't know. I'm just repeating a slogan from TV. Is there more to it than that? I don't know. You tell me, Mr. Nuclear Physicist Man. And then, you know, you get a bunch of nonsense about science and verification and inspections and percentages and mathematics and history, details. It can be difficult to, you know, get a slogan going when you're too busy with the facts. But anyway, I think that might be part of how you can tell it's true. Oh, that was a pretty good waste of the first segment. When we get back, I'm going to answer a question I got on Twitter. I don't want to start now because I don't know if I really have more than 3 minutes worth of stuff to say about this, but maybe I do, and I'd hate to give the answer short shrift. But the question by way of Twitter was, what about the Barbary Pirates, huh, Mr. Libertarian? Yeah, I got an answer for that. Are you amazed I have an answer for something? I do. So I'm going to answer that on the other side of the break here. And then I guess the other news is that the stock market's taken a dive, and I'm going to have Mike Swanson on the show from Wall Street Window to talk about that tomorrow. He's been warning you for a long time. In fact, you might hear, you know, automatically play during this break that commercial where I'm saying, Mike's saying, get the hell out of the stock market right now before it crashes. Yeah, well, good advice. I mean, that is, if you weren't completely wiped out back in 2008, you actually had something in the stock market to get out with. And he's saying, yeah, this is the bear. This isn't just a correction. This is the beginning of the downturn again. And what can they do? There's nothing else they can do. You can only push on a string so much. There's nobody pulling. It's fun as hell, too, to watch all the socialists on Twitter saying, yeah, I guess capitalism failed us again. Oh, really, huh? Yeah, it's almost like we haven't had liberals and conservatives in power for the last 230 years. Yeah, ever since Ron Paul won the election in 2008 in some parallel universe, and we've been living in a laissez-faire economy since then. Ever since Ron stopped all the bailouts and stopped all the quantitative easing, ended all the regulations. That's what brought this on. Right, everybody? We haven't had a Democrat in power for the last 6 years. They haven't been printing money. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Jacob Hornberger, tireless champion of liberty and president of the FFF, brings you the best libertarian writers every month on the topics that need our treatment the most. Read Jacob, Jim Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Joe Stromberg, and more every month in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the pocket-sized print edition. 15 to read it online. The Future of Freedom. FFF.org/subscribe.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy mostly. Check out my website, scotthorton.org. Oops, by the way, I forgot to join up the chat room this morning. I am not a robot, I promise. scotthorton.org/chat. And you can join up the chat room with the boys. Sometimes some girls, I don't know. Also, it's an IRC free node chat room, hashtag Scott Horton Show if you want to hang out in there. Morning, guys. It's a mostly empty chat room, but there's a few people in there. So join up, man. Make some pseudo computer type friends. All right. So, yeah, this is my show. Lots to cover on the show today. First of all, like I said, I had a Twitter question about the Barbary Wars, Thomas Jefferson and the Barbary Pirates, and what has a libertarian got to say about that? Well, the first thing is, I don't think that, as far as I know, Murray Rothbard never wrote about that. I don't know that there is an official libertarian treatment. Is there a Justin Raimondo article about the Barbary Wars? I guess I could have looked at antiwar.com. I don't think so, but any libertarian can tell you the same thing. Thomas Jefferson's a communist. What in the hell is this? People who had nothing to do with shipping in the Mediterranean are forced at gunpoint to pay for the security of people shipping through the Mediterranean? Let them hire their own security. And even under the Constitution, if you accept the, you know, collectivist premise of the Constitution and its collective security at all, that's for the United States of America. That's not for Americans anywhere in the world they go. Otherwise, what you're saying is Americans have the right to live in a world empire. Americans have the right to live in a society where the government is so powerful that it can wage war against any other power anywhere they might get in trouble anywhere else on the planet. Now, does that make sense for any other state? Every other country in the world ought to be powerful enough, ought to have an empire enough that they can go and enforce sea lanes here, there, the other place. And why is the U.S. Navy... why are the American taxpayers, by way of the U.S. Navy, subsidizing security for all the American corporations who manufacture all their stuff in other people's countries right now? Now, I'm for the globalization of trade in every way, and I think nation states don't really exist, and there's just people, and people have the right to trade with each other, and I'm all for that. I'm not for the government intervening and subsidizing companies in order to try to encourage them to pull up shop, pull up stakes and go overseas. Maybe labor's cheaper over there, but there are other considerations too. Like, for example, who's going to protect you on the high seas? You're going to have to hire your own security, Walmart? Or don't worry, Uncle Sam's going to pick up the tab. We're a global force for good. Yeah, the American government socializing the costs for the rich at the expense of the poor, just like with everything else. So, Thomas Jefferson is a totalitarian. No right to tax people to pay for a navy to go sail far, far away in order to kill Africans, in order to secure safe passage of American shipping. And if you believe in empire, then fine. But I don't. I probably would settle for a temporary limited constitutional republic if I could get one. But I can't see one from here anyway. Not since Jefferson turned America into an empire, after all. But anyway, so yeah, there you go. That's the libertarian answer to the Navy doing things. We're against that. Okay, now here's the other thing. I just saw the headline, assuming this is right, and they're adjusting for inflation and this, that, and whatever hell. Let's see, war powers. Oh, I guess I should say, the Constitution does authorize letters of marque and reprisal, although, it is kind of open-ended, but it doesn't say, I don't know how open-ended, maybe it's closed-ended. There's no implication that says that Congress can issue letters of marque and reprisal for anyone anywhere in the world for aggressive reasons, right? If someone in the Indian Ocean is pirating French ships, does America have the right to issue a letter of marque over that? Anyway. Yeah. They should have used a letter of marque. Ron Paul introduced a letter of marque to go after Bin Laden. A power less than a state. Yeah, about a ship full of pirates. That was about right. A couple hundred of them. But yeah, they didn't go for that. They went for the open-ended authorization to do anything to anyone forever. Which, unfortunately, he voted for. I mean, it doesn't say that, but that's what they interpreted it to mean, of course. Gulf of Tonkin Plus. It applies not just in Afghanistan, but in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, again. Supposedly, they needed an authorization in 2003, a separate authorization, because it had nothing to do with the authorization to use force on those who did the 9/11 attack. Oh, but then after that invasion and the turning of the entire western half of the country into Bin Laden's stand, now we can apply the authorization to use military force from O2 in Iraq. In 2014 and 15, like we couldn't in 2003 and 4. That's something. That is something. Oh, yeah. So now, the TV, man, it was saying in its closed caption kind of a way that some of these numbers are the lowest they've been since 1999. That was the commodities, which I say, good deal, man. Invest in metals right now if you can. Buy metals, they're crashing. I mean, well, let them crash a little more maybe and then buy them. But everything else is going down, down, down. And so here's the part of the show. I don't always do this, but yeah, sometimes I do. Where I say this. Doesn't matter if you're a conservative. Doesn't matter if you're a liberal or any kind of progressive or socialist or anywhere on any kind of scale. Doesn't matter if you agree with libertarians or Austrian school economists on any other thing. You have to accept the truth of the Austrian explanation of the business cycle. And that is, it's caused by the expansion of bank credit. And the reason the banks are able to expand credit the way that they are is because they have the bank, the central bank, the Federal Reserve, as their lender of last resort. It's all bailouts all the time. Not just when there's a big crash. Every night, every day, any bank needs money, the government gives it to them. They're encouraged and subsidized to make bad loans. Doesn't matter. Just keep expanding credit and keep expanding credit. And when they do that, then that creates distortions in the economy. You could have widespread price inflation, or you could have inflation just in certain markets like dot-coms or housing, mortgage derivatives or fuel prices or whatever it is. But then those artificial bubbles pop. And we get the very real crashes. Dig it? Austrian theory. Learn it. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Hey, y'all, hang on. I'm trying to get her. Just listen to this instead for a second.
And then the king turned back to me after a couple of minutes, and he said, okay, we'll do it. But he had two conditions. One, that you'll bring enough force to do it right and to get it done. And secondly, that you'll leave when it's over with. And I committed, gave him my word on that basis. I knew that's what the president wanted to do anyway.
The president had already, in effect, authorized you to... Had said we were
I was there to close the deal, in effect.
Yeah.
All right, y'all. Welcome back. Sorry, I'm running around like a chicken with my head cut off over here. I don't know. But, yeah, there you go. Sorry to put Dick Cheney in your ear hole. I bet half the audience has turned their volume all the way down. I don't want to hear Dick Cheney say something. It's a good little bit of trivia there, though. All right. Well, anyway. Our first guest on the show today is Sonali Kolhatkar, and I'm sorry, ma'am, for not pronouncing your name correctly.
You did perfectly.
Oh, really?
Wow, yeah.
All right. Hey, and get this. You're on KPFK just like me. You do the morning drive time show Uprising, huh? That's good.
Yes, for about 12, 13 years now.
Oh, cool. Well, I live in Texas, so I don't listen to KPFK as much as I should, but I'm on Sunday mornings. I don't know if you ever heard of anti-war radio.
I have not. I'm in Southern California. KPFK is the sister station to KPFT. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but we're part of the same network.
I'm on in LA. That's why I said KPFK.
Oh, you're on in LA. Oh, okay.
Yeah, because I used to live out there, so I got the show out there, and then I came back to Texas, but I kept my show out there.
Ah, okay.
Anyway, so Sunday mornings at 8:30, probably when you're sleeping.
Probably.
Yeah. Anyway. Alan keeps saying he's going to give me back my... I was on Friday nights there for a couple of years. But, all right. Anyway. Hi. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for writing this great article that you wrote. It was the spotlight on antiwar.com the other day. Why are we ignoring the war on Yemen? I'm glad that you're not. I'm only ignoring it because I have so little opportunity to interview people about it. So few people are writing about it. Why don't you tell us, you know, whatever it is that you got to say, what do you think is most important for people to understand about what's going on in Yemen?
Well, first of all, if we put it in just in terms of the power dynamics, Yemen, before the Saudi, you know, airplane started bombing it in March of this year, was the poorest country in the Persian Gulf. That in and of itself should tell you something. Yemen shares a border with the richest country in the Persian Gulf, which is Saudi Arabia. And, you know, I can get into the political reasons why Saudi Arabia has started bombing. But if we think about the fact that Saudi Arabia, which has bought the majority of Middle East weapons sold by the United States and used those weapons along with U.S. advisors to bludgeon the poorest country in the Persian Gulf so much that 10 million children are at risk of starvation. I think in a nutshell, that says it all. And it's really shocking that the Western news media are not reporting on it as much as they should. Now, who is calling the alarm are all the major global humanitarian organizations. Doctors Without Borders issued a major report, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, UNICEF, Save the Children. You name the humanitarian organization, they have put out a report sounding the alarm. And they have used words like catastrophe, on the brink of starvation. They've used the most, you know, the strongest hyperbolic terms, because those terms sadly in this case apply. And that's why I wrote the article that I did on TrueStick. It shocked me that there was such a deep and widespread humanitarian catastrophe unfolding in Yemen, that if anybody other than the U.S. and Saudi Arabia had been the perpetrator, you would have members of Congress screaming about intervention to stop this kind of disaster. Instead, because we're involved, there's deafening silence.
Yeah. Well, we did have a guy from Oxfam come on to talk about it, and you have links here in your article. Again, it's at truthdig.com. Why are we ignoring the war on Yemen? Links to all the different humanitarian organizations and their warnings. And the big part of that, as you say, the poorest country from the get-go, But also, as Patrick Coburn first pointed out, before the war really broke out, I think, or right when it first broke out, 90% of Yemen's food comes from imports, pre-war, you know, all things being equal. They import 90% of their food. So all that is completely cut off. So now my only question is, how can people be on the brink for so long? They must have starved to death by now. It's 4 months later.
Yeah, in fact, if you look up photos of Yemen's children, it is shocking. It reminds me of the kinds of sort of stereotypical photos of starving children that we were shown in the 1980s of children in Ethiopia, ribs sticking out, hollowed cheeks, eyes bulging out. It gave me nightmares to think about what we have unleashed on Yemen. And you're right in pointing out that it is importing so much of its food, because what the bombing has done and what Saudi Arabia has very deliberately gone after are those access points, the ports through which aid has come in and traditionally has come in. Just earlier last week, they bombed Port Hodeidah, which is a very major port that prompted one aid worker to say that it really should be seen as the last straw, cutting off yet again the meager food supplies that have been coming in from the outside. There's such and Saudi Arabia has been ignoring UN requests for ceasefires just for humanitarian grounds. The UN has been calling, and Ban Ki-moon has been very frustrated with Saudi Arabia. Basically, they've been calling for a few days of a pause in the bombing to allow only for humanitarian purposes food to be brought in. And Saudi Arabia has time and again violated those ceasefires or simply ignored them. And the U.S. has increased the number of advisors for intelligence purposes that it has given Saudi Arabia to fight this war. So we are tremendously complicit.
Yeah, now, and that's the thing. There's been so little reporting about, you know, much of this, you know, like you're saying here. But the part that, you know, is most compelling to me anyway, other than just the brutality of it, of course, is the American role. And there's been such a lack of detail. The Wall Street Journal ran a thing that 2 months ago now, or maybe more than that, 10 weeks ago or something, saying that, oh, yeah, you know, America's running the whole thing, picking the targets. The LA Times was saying, yeah, they're sending more people over to help pick targets. But I'm only inferring, I don't think I can pin this down, but I'm only inferring that America must be running air traffic control for the entire thing. It's the Saudis, I mean, I know they have AWACS, but they're not running their own air war. That's gotta be the United States at sea and in their AWACS, you know, directing the sorties to their targets, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I hate to only assume that, but I can't find much reporting. You know, even in that LA Times story, they don't really get into exactly what are they doing other than sitting at a table looking at pictures and picking targets, you know?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right to point out the fact that the U.S. is, you know, behind the scenes. The Saudi Arabia is dropping bombs. And then on the ground, we have troops from the United Arab Emirates that just up to the ante. Again, not very well reported. The UAE does not get very involved in wars very often, particularly sending in ground troops, but they've sent in ground troops. And if you look at who are the top two weapons buyers in the Middle East from the United States, it's Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And so we've armed these two countries that are going in. And another important point that I think needs to be brought up is the fact that Saudi Arabia is claiming, or one of the main reasons that Saudi Arabia is giving for fighting this war is to try to undermine Iranian influence in the region, because Iran, they fear, are supporting the Houthi rebels on the ground in Yemen, except that President Obama has openly, of course, tried to make peace with Iran and has even said in an interview, and I reported on this Micristic piece, that that the Iranians have, in fact, played a role that has tried to hold back the Houthis. So why is the United States helping Saudi Arabia fight a war against Iranian influence when the United States is trying to make peace with Iran? As usual, we have the U.S. fighting both sides of a war.
Yep, absolutely. All right, now I'm sorry, we got to pause and take this break. We'll be right back, y'all, with Sonali Kolhatkar from KPFK in Los Angeles with this great article, Why Are We Ignoring the War on Yemen, at truthdig.com. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on with Sonali Kolhatkar from KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., where sometimes they play my show and sometimes they don't. She's got this great piece at truthdig.com. Why are we ignoring the war on Yemen? And you know, I don't know, a little bit of background, of course. It's a bit of a regime change operation. America eased out their old sock puppet, replaced him with the vice president, but then the people overthrew him. Well, really, the Houthi rebels from the north, the Zaydis from the north, came and ran him out of town, ran him out of the country. And then so the Saudis and I guess the whole GCC and with American coordination have been bombing the crap out of him for about 4 months now. They're in a huge humanitarian crisis. They have very little food resources of their own. And as the guest from Oxfam was saying a couple of weeks back, even what food is produced, all the markets are bombed and destroyed and all the distribution channels are gone. So there's just no way to distribute it. And this is in a country where, again, they import 90% of their food on a good day. And so it's the worst humanitarian catastrophe on earth right now, at least right up there with Syria. Anyway, so one of the things that you brought up right there before the break there was how the excuse is that the Houthis aren't just the Houthis. The Houthis are the Hezbollah of Yemen, and they are a front for the new Persian Empire that is taking over the Middle East. And so, or at least, this is a sop to the Saudis that we'll help them with this if they'll tolerate our nuclear deal with Iran or something like that. But what do you think of the real politics going on here? Why are the Saudis so insistent they're willing to go through all this just to put Hadi back in power? And is there any hope of that, even with a ground invasion?
Well, I don't know how long Yemen is going to be able to stand up to Saudi pressure, but if you look at what's happening beyond the Yemen war, a pattern emerges. Saudi Arabia is claiming that it wants Hadi back in power because he was democratically elected. He was the person who he wasn't democratically elected. Actually, he was appointed leader. He was vice president under Abdel Salah, the dictator of Yemen, who was toppled by as a result of the Arab Spring. And the Arab Spring revolutions. And there you have, I think, a real indication of why Saudi Arabia is so worried about what's happening, not just in Yemen, but in Bahrain, in Egypt, and in other countries. What the Saudi war in Yemen is about overall is to squash democratic aspirations. The Houthi rebels took over, kicked out Hadi, and were hoping, whether you agree with them or not, whether they're necessarily representative of all Yemenis, that's a debatable point. But they wanted, and they were open to, some kind of power sharing in a democratic government. The Saudis do not want the idea that one can start a rebellion and be part of a future government to spread. They don't want that idea to spread in the Arab world. And this is a big part of the reason why, with U.S. backing, Saudi Arabia has undermined every step that it can, everywhere that it can, Arab Spring revolutions. And so we need to look at that in the bigger perspective. We need to look at that pattern that is, you know, fairly obscured, sadly, by the mainstream media coverage here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, their policy is just
you know, maybe good for them in the short or medium term, they think, but it's certainly contrary to American national interests. If you look at, for example, all the blowback from the military coup, the Saudi and more or less American-sponsored military coup in Egypt there, where all they did was prove Zawahiri right, that the Muslim Brotherhood are fools for trying to participate in Western ways of democracy and all of this stuff, and might as well fight because they never let you win, even if you did win. And all they did was say, you know, whatever that Al-Qaeda guy just said, we're going to prove it true right now. And so now they've got, you know, just as anybody could have predicted back then, and you know, when they did the coup in 2013, that this is just going to prove Al-Qaeda right and lead to a whole new generation of, you know, guerrilla warfare, basically in Egypt, which has been mostly at peace this whole time.
Absolutely. And, you know, another thing we should bring up on Yemen is that Al-Qaeda is still very much active in Yemen. The Saudis have had various connections to Al-Qaeda over the years. But the U.S., while it's supporting a Saudi war against Houthis, continues its drone war against Al-Qaeda. So well before Saudi Arabia began bombing Yemen in March, the U.S., since the Bush era, had been intermittently bombing so-called high-value targets inside Yemen with drones. And as the Saudi war has progressed, the U.S. has not stopped its bombing campaign and just recently killed people that they say were five suspected militants with Al-Qaeda. And the Al-Qaeda branch of Yemen, which is considered one of the most dangerous, is, you know, continuing to issue threats against the U.S. And we've seen the pattern that the more the U.S. goes after Al-Qaeda, the more dangerous the world becomes for Americans, the more threats that get issued and the more terrorism and risks of terrorism actually increase. And so overlapping with the Saudi war on Yemen and the impact on civilians is the U.S.'s ongoing drone war in Yemen, which has also shown to kill civilians when it has missed the so-called suspected militants.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I mean, switching off from one side to the other, first we back Saddam, then we back the Ayatollah a little bit and back and forth and overthrow Saddam for the Ayatollah and this and that and go back and forth. But fighting outright for both sides at the very same time, on the very same day, helping Al-Qaeda advance on the Houthis while bombing them too is really something else.
Yeah, and this is a problem. I mean, if we try to disentangle U.S. policy in the Middle East between 9/11 and now, what you have is something that has almost no rhyme or reason. The pattern that is emerging is so, I mean, if you just even focus on Syria for a minute, the pattern that emerges is so complicated, is so counterintuitive, that the only thing that you can predict with any degree of certainty is that U.S. involvement has increased chaos, increased violence, increased poverty, increased political instability, and undermined the democracy every step of the way. And it's very, very sad. And you know, it really needs to stop. I know that with the focus on economic inequality here in the U.S. in light of the presidential election, Americans are paying less attention to our foreign policy. But frankly, our foreign policy under President Obama has been one that the Republicans have been on board with. And if you know, if you're against anything that the Republicans are for, you need to be against Obama's foreign policy.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, if we had anybody up there out of the 25 people running for president right now, if one of them was honest and wanted to fight about it, he could tie the rest of these guys all in knots for their various positions and just, you know, make hash out of them. It shouldn't be any problem whatsoever. And I don't see Bernie Sanders doing it. I don't see Rand Paul doing it. I don't see anybody doing it. They're all just lining up to see who can be worse on everything.
Right. And in fact, Norman Solomon, a longtime activist who ran for Congress, a congressional seat himself, and who is the founder of RootsAction.org, he appeared on my show last week talking about the petition that tens of thousands of people have signed urging Bernie Sanders to start talking about foreign policy. You're right. There's a huge opening there, which, you know, any presidential candidate could make hay of the other candidates if they were to simply try to disentangle what's happening on the other side of the pond. The one foreign policy issue that the Republicans and Democrats are disagreeing over is the issue of lifting sanctions on Iran. In the margins, you'll find Democrats being slightly better than the Republicans, but on the issues that matter, sadly, they're both on the same team.
Yeah. Well, there's a slight discrepancy in Syria whether we ought to finish overthrowing Assad for the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda or whether we ought to just continue helping both sides bleed each other to death forever.
Yeah, you know, and this is a really important point. Look, the U.S. has a lot of leverage over Saudi Arabia, much more so than we'd like to admit. The U.S. has a lot of leverage over countries like the United Arab Emirates. It holds not only the purse strings for weapons, but it holds the export markets for oil. It, you know, the currencies of a lot of these Gulf countries are pegged to the dollar. And if the U.S. were to actually exercise some of that leverage in the right direction, in the short term, we could see something much more constructive than what we're seeing now. In the long term, the U.S. needs to certainly give up that political power. And we're seeing that very slowly in a world where, you know, sort of a multipolar world where you see centers of power like Russia and China emerging to challenge the United States. But in the short term, in the Middle East, at least, the U.S. reigns supreme, and it does. It's doing a very, very destructive job with its policy.
All right, everybody. That is Sonali Kolhatkar. She is the founder, host, and producer of KPFK's morning program, Uprising, 90.7 FM in L.A., and wrote this very important article at Truth Dig, Why Are We Ignoring the War on Yemen? Thank you, Sonali. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Dr. Yosef Butt, nuclear physicist and senior advisor to the British American Security Information Council and director at the Cultural Intelligence Institute. Welcome back to the show, Yosef. How are you doing?
Good, good. Good to be back.
Good, good. Happy to have you here. Lots to talk about on the show today. Of course, we're in that interim period here where the UN Security Council, including the U.S. Executive Branch, has signed this deal with the Iranians, the final deal, but we're still waiting for Congress to try to kill it or not and see how successful they are with that. And they still have time, and so in the meantime, they're coming out with as much propaganda as they can to try to ruin the deal. And obviously the latest was the big one. Well, I don't know if it's the latest. Maybe there's another one since then. But the big one last week, anyway, centered around good old George John at the Associated Press with a story about a deal between the IAEA and the Iranians for the implementation of their inspection of the Parchin military facility that basically just gave the Iranians the store and let them go ahead and take all their own samples. And, you know, basically, as I think a Republican congressman put it, this is like asking Olympic athletes to provide all their own urine samples without, you know, great example, I guess, for the intrusiveness. But anyway, so I'm getting to the point, Yosef, and that is that I interviewed this guy, Tariq Ralph, from Atomic Reporters, former official at the IAEA, apparently at a pretty high level there. And he said that he thought that the document that these accusations were based on, which AP, after they were criticized, published the document, or at least a representation of the document, and he said it was so badly flawed that he thought you couldn't blame it on George John. He's not that lousy of a reporter. It must have been a bogus document in the first place. And so let's start with that and what you think of Tariq Ralph's argument there.
I think that argument may be fine. I think the document at hand could be a draft document, which I think Jan admits to. So I think we shouldn't read too much into, nitpick it too much. Also, the administration has not actually contradicted anything in the main gist of what was contained in the document. Mm-hmm. So my take on it is the gist of it is correct, that the Iranians will be leading the inspections at this Parchin site, which there's accusations from 10, 13 years ago that there might have been some nuclear weapons related research using conventional explosives. But my take is also that this is not a big deal, because it's common for, in inspections, that usually what will happen is there's two inspectors, one's called dirty and one's called clean. The dirty guy goes in and he's the one doing the actual sampling, taking this ultra clean cloth and swiping it across surfaces, and he hands it to the clean guy who's got the little baggie that they put it in, and then they send off these samples to various laboratories around the world. So it's common that the inspectors from the country will be the dirty inspector, will be the ones doing the actual sampling, and they'll hand it over to the official IAEA person who's got the clean title, and he's got the little baggie that they put it in. So it's my take on it is this is like a tempest in the teapot. It's not a big deal that Iranians are involved in sampling, because there will be IAEA monitors there. That's my understanding, at least.
So in other words, whether or not it's a forgery, we're talking about taking one line out of context and implying that since the line doesn't continue to go on and describe the process whereby, yes, there will be a white Northern European guy standing there in a lab coat looking, then that must mean that there won't be, and therefore they're letting the Iranians inspect themselves.
Well, I think the story just got mangled because there was various versions of it online and various deletions. So I think what the brouhaha was about was it was initially being cast as there will be no IAEA inspectors with these people, and the Iranians will just go in and swipe whatever and just bring out the samples. That's not the case, as far as I know. What the latest reports show is there'll be Iranians doing the swiping, and there will be IAEA monitors closely monitoring them, which is unremarkable. That's just that's actually normal procedure.
Right.
So ideally, you'd like to have completely no Iranian involvement, and it's just purely IAEA inspectors. But that already doesn't happen sometimes. So it's just not a big deal at all, even if these reports are true.
Yeah, I think that was Ralph's point was, the document saying that the Iranians are going to do it, or maybe it could have been read to imply that there won't be an IAEA inspector there on site or something like that. That was why he said it must be a forgery, because it is absolutely inconceivable that any country would ever get a deal, especially Iran in this case, but that any country would ever get a deal where, okay, you guys go in there and get us a swipe and bring it out, and we'll be waiting out here for you in the parking lot or whatever. That's just not how business is done.
Right,
ever.
Right. And I think what the issue is in this draft document, it just doesn't touch upon that. It just, it just tells you about the Iranian side, and it doesn't tell you that there'll be IAEA monitors, which doesn't mean that there won't. It just means that it's not mentioned.
Right.
And that might be normal procedure in a draft, like when you're putting down a draft of something that's going to be finalized, you're putting down the minimum amount, but that doesn't mean other things won't be added in later. So the crucial thing being there will be IAEA monitors closely monitoring whatever happens, and it doesn't matter who the guy is who's actually doing the swiping, as long as you're looking over his shoulder, you're recording his movements, and everything's on video, or at least there's a close monitoring of them live by IAEA official inspectors.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so
At this point, it's sort of a side issue, but maybe not. What do you think of all those errors in that draft of the draft that the AP put out?
I mean, I'm not an expert in it. I defer to Ralph on that. He has far more experience in that. But like I said, for me, it's not even a big deal, even if that document is true, because it's not raising a red flag in any way. Like I said, as long as there's IEA monitors in there, that's not a problem, and it's inconceivable that there won't be. So,
right. Gotcha.
And I think that's the latest release from the administration also mentions that there will be IEA inspectors. And yes, the Iranians might be involved in the process. But, I had a piece out last week about why this might be and related to the errors that happened in Syria. So that may be why the Iranians had a case for doing it this way.
Yeah, go ahead and tell that story real quick if you could.
So there was reports mentioned by Peter Jennings, who's a former UK ambassador to the IAEA. Mm-hmm. His contacts informed him that there was improper process during the Syria investigation at Al Kibar, where one of the lead inspectors took a swipe and then put, you know, at an improper place and then put it in his pocket instead of, you know, putting it in this clean baggie. So, and that was the only swipe apparently that came back with signatures of man-made uranium. There was also three other swipes taken and they did not register this man-made uranium. Mm-hmm. So the only uranium-containing sample was the one that was improperly handled.
All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back, sure, everybody, with Dr. Yosef Butt, nuclear physicist, on the Iran talks and deal and all that, the propaganda. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I am talking with Dr. Yosef Butt, nuclear physicist from the British American Security Information Council and director at the Cultural Intelligence Institute. And we were talking about the propaganda war against the Iran deal. I'm pretty sure they're going to never run out of these stories about, you know, just all you got to do, take a sentence out of context, say it means another thing, dominate the news cycle for a week with breathless accusations, and then ultimately the truth doesn't matter at all. The narrative carries the day. That's basically the uphill battle we're trying to resist here. And, you know, the funny thing about it is it has us on the same side as the president, so it's not exactly, you know, destined to be a losing battle. Even though the other party controls the Congress, it seems like he probably has the votes to get this deal done. But now, you know, the narrative is working on people. I mean, it really, people think that this is a deal to give them nuclear weapons. I know that Obama's a lousy president, but I can't believe he's just giving the Iranians nuclear weapons like this. I mean, people, yeah, you know, they don't know. They just try to regurgitate as best they can, what they thought they heard. And, so I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about, you know, what the deal actually says about the centrifuges and the reactors. And I guess really I'm most interested in the two reactors, Arak, that's A-R-A-K, Arak and Bushehr, and what you know about them, how they work, and what the deal says about how they will be made to work in the future, and what that means for possible production of weapons-grade plutonium as waste at those reactors. Could you explain that part of it to us?
Sure. The Arak one, ARAK, is the one of interest for plutonium production. What the deal says, and currently it could yield a lot of plutonium if it's separated out, if there's a reprocessing plant to separate out the plutonium. The deal would modify the core of that reactor to make it so that it produces a lot less plutonium. So we definitely want something like that. If you're interested in Iran not having even the possibility of weaponizing the future, you should back the deal, because it cuts off that path enormously. Not that Iran seems to be jumping at any opportunity to make a bomb, because even our U.S. national, the Director of National Intelligence weighed in earlier and said he has a high level of confidence that Iran is not currently weaponizing, and is, whatever research and experiments that they were doing were shut down in 2003. So, coming back to your point, Scott, about the news cycle, et cetera, it's funny. David Sanger had a couple of pieces out just over the weekend, and there's serious flaws in them. For instance, the one on Parchin, he mentions categorically that the IAEA went there once, but in fact they went there twice already in 2005, in January and November. So I had written in, and they have still not corrected it. You know, I'm not sure what's why they're persisting with this, but it's these kind of small errors that keep adding up and add to suspicion over Iran's intentions. And there's a report
especially
out today.
The New York Times, the newspaper of record. And, of course, regular listeners to this show know for years we've covered David Sanger and his heirs. For 4 or 5 or more years straight in a row, he consistently referred, just offhand without ever proving it, he would just refer to Iran's illicit nuclear weapons program and just assert its existence for, and the rest of, every other town newspaper basically follows the lead of the New York Times on issues like that. And he's made himself very clear in his various interviews with Charlie Rose and that kind of thing, where he stands on all this. Well, I think they probably have a secret parallel program somewhere in this kind of thing. So in other words, he's a complete kook fit for the basement of AEI or the Center for Security Policy or something.
Yeah, but, and it's not even just errors in reporting. It's the choice of what you choose to report on and what the editors let pass worth publishing. For instance, his latest piece is something completely well known that, yes, there's a sunset clause in the deal that, 10, 15 years from now, the restrictions begin to be cut off and Iran goes back into a normal monitoring, like a NPT state with the additional protocol, which is fine. I mean, that's better than where we are right now. So he has this big fear-mongering article out saying, oh, well, there's all these concerns that in, 10, 15 years from now that Iran will be able to weaponize. Well, I mean, that's not news. Anybody who's following the Iran deal knows exactly what it is, and then that, these restrictions come off in 10 or 15 years. So I don't even know why the New York Times published that. It's just, rehashing old news that's been known for months. And just trying just to come at this critical time and just, highlight these fears for no reason.
Yeah. Well, and of course, nowhere in there does it say, truth be told, they mastered the fuel cycle 10 years ago and they could have made nukes this whole time. They could have been bluffing when they were enriching up to 20% and then gone ahead and raced for 90% and try to make a Hiroshima bomb gun type nuke out of it real quick. But then, no, they didn't. You don't want to have to explain that.
Sure, and if you're afraid that Iran might do that in 10 or 15 years, certainly you should be afraid that they might do that right away, which is what, which is a possibility.
Right.
If the deal is not done.
Yeah, so, you scientists and your logical games trying to trick me.
So, so we have our Judy Millers at the New York Times these days, too.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's been consistently horrible. And it's actually a fun game if you go back and look through his archives. Wherever it's Broad and Sanger, it's always worse. But if they ever team him up with Mazzetti, then he'll be forced to admit that, well, they are under the NPT. And I don't know whether there's really a causation of that correlation. That's just the way it seems to me. Like, well, they are an NPT member. But you're right. I mean, the way they categorize, like, once the deal is over, then they'll be free to make a nuke. Well, they're not free to make a nuke now in the sense that they could withdraw from the treaty. But as long as they're within the treaty, they're not free to. They promise
right.
not to.
And there'll be IAEA monitoring and, additional protocol. And if you're afraid they're going to do it in 10 or 15 years, you should certainly be afraid they'll do it tomorrow, which is
right. And as you say, the additional protocol is indefinite. And that's really something, right? It sounds like some boring old international legal term, but what all does the additional protocol mean?
Yeah, I mean, basically, it includes more facilities where if the IAEA suspect that they can have easier access, they don't have to be subject to any stalling by the Iranians. They can just be they can gain easier access to any additional facilities or mines or whatnot that has anything to do with the nuclear fuel cycle. So it just gives them basically more intrusive. Gives the IAEA more intrusive inspection rights in a given country.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, last question here real quick, music's playing. How hilarious is it going to be when they find no trace of any explosives testing chamber at Parchin anywhere?
Well, the interesting thing is there's a lot of discussion over that. Cheryl Rofer had an article out in that saying, well, if they don't find it, either there was never anything there or that they managed to hide it. Well, if that's the case, why bother going? It's like damned if they do and damned if they don't. So it's kind of pointless.
The best excuses for war are never falsifiable.
Right.
You got to make sure that you have your escape
hatch
built
in. Robert Kelly has a good piece in Low Blog saying, it's not so much the sampling, it's the addition, the structure of the building and what's inside it that the inspectors might find, which might be of interest. So, I'd definitely go and listen to what Kelly's saying, given his background and experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And anybody can find that stuff at cipri.org and at lowblog.com as well. All right. Well, listen, thanks very much for coming back on the show. Keep writing about this. We need you out there.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Sure, appreciate it. That's Dr. Yosef Butt, everybody. He is at the Huffington Post with this one, Why the IAEA Would Yield to Iran on Inspecting the Parchin Weapons Site. And also, he's known for his angry letters to the editor of the New York Times. And we'll be right back in just a sec. Hey, all, Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. And thanks, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, y'all. All right, so you know what? I don't know, man, if it makes any difference or not. I guess it probably doesn't, but it's not really meant to make a difference, really. It's meant just to be a place where people can go if they're looking for something. Hey, Uncle Bob, actually, I heard this show where it turns out that the Fox narrative on that ain't quite all you need to know. I don't know, maybe. If it's useful to you, I hope it's useful to you, Man, it would really suck if no one was pushing back on the war party narrative. The Israel lobby is spending, $50 million or $150 million or some incredible number of tens of millions of dollars. Now the Saudis,
Remember I couldn't find the tab last week? I found the tab. It was in my brain. It was an Intercept article. The Saudis are now bankrolling an entirely new and separate campaign against the Iran deal, along with the Israelis. And they're spending tens of millions of dollars. And, you know, it's as stupid as any war propaganda ever is, you know? They say every Muslim in your town is trying to kill you. Well, then how come it hadn't come to blows yet? Because there are thousands of Muslims in your town, at least. Maybe tens of thousands or hundreds. Well, yeah, I don't know. Maybe if you live in Michigan, hundreds of thousands. There are many Muslims near you. None of them are trying to kill you. You know? If this was all about, wow, their religion makes them want to kill you, then what the hell's the matter with them all? What's taking them so long to do what they're doing? They're not. That's not what's going on here. But you have to stop and just think about it for a minute. Well, if that's true, then how come dot, dot, dot? You know? Something like that. Well, geez, if this deal is all about Obama handing Iran nuclear weapons so that they can kill all the Israelis, then how come the president is doing that? Does that really sound right to you? I mean, even if, you know, you disagree with me that Obama is more a half-white conservative nationalist imperialist than a half-black, you know, panther, left-wing radical communist or whatever kind of right-wing caricature of him. Still, you really think he's trying to help Iran get a nuke to bomb Israel? Doesn't that sound stupid to you? You don't ask yourself, well, wait, maybe actually I just listened to stupid right-wing slogan-chanting liars and I ought to actually read for a minute or something like that? Why would the Democrats do something like that? You think the Democrats aren't owned by the Israel lobby just as much as you and your Republicans are? Give me a break. Iran's nuclear program is already safeguarded. Now it's going to be extra double safeguarded. Get it? Even more safeguarded, more inspected, less uranium at lower percentages of the good stuff. No more 20%, just 3.6 and just a little bit, not a big pile. And the Bushehr reactors spitting out crap that you can't make nukes out of anyway. Or the Iraq and Bushehr, whatever, both of them are both not making weapons-grade plutonium. So there you go. Anyway, what's funny is I just want to not have to care about this anymore or have to explain it anymore. I want to live in a world where everybody knows. They got the additional protocol, man. It's cool. Them hyping hypers are just lying to you. They're betting on how foolish you are. But that world's not coming anyway, right? Obama's going to get the deal, and it's going to be just as bad as ever. David Sanger and George Yon. Oh, I said his name wrong. Not sorry for the disrespect for this liar posing as a journalist. Still going to live in a world of Sanger and Yon and of Benjamin Netanyahu and his massive stinking piles of crap all the time. So anyway, same old story. Anyway. And by the way, does everybody know this? Everybody knows this, right? A war with Iran would break America. I mean, it's not like we couldn't win. You send in the Army and the Marine Corps and all the special forces to go after their anti-aircraft stuff and get the Navy and the giant guns. And never mind nukes. We can conventionally bomb the living hell out of Iran and occupy it. But it'll take every last penny we can't borrow. It'll be the end of the federal budget. And it would mean the return of conscription. Can you imagine what a disaster that would be? And that's the only way to live up to Benjamin Netanyahu's standard of no nuclear program in Iran whatsoever may exist under any treaty or any terms at all. NPT, never heard of it, actually. Israel? What's an NPT? They're not members of that. Safeguards Agreement? They don't have one of those. Additional protocol to what again? So, that's it. And yet, they're not going to invade and occupy Iran. And even if Obama gave them all the bunker busters and long-range bombers to drop them with, that would still only turn their civilian safeguarded nuclear program into a weapons program. Anyway, so, you know, America could occupy the place for a little while and then lose. And then whoever's next, be sure to make nukes after that, don't you think? And then also America will prove that definitely it's at war with all of Islam. We trade off back and forth, but the agenda is to kill all of y'all, apparently. That'll be the message, you know, read loud and clear from Jordan to Indonesia, I guess. But, you know, they'll only mind because of how evil their religion is, not because they identify with our victims or anything like that. That would make sense. But anyway, you know, it is kind of fun once you actually understand a little bit about the nuclear program to just see all the BS as it comes forward and debunk it. You know, there's this piece by Jim White over at Empty Wheels blog. This guy's great on Iran nuclear issues and always has been. Washington shocked that AP's Georgian is a tool for Iran deal opponents. Yep, all got taken again. Well, but for those of us who have seen this before, oh, a new Georgian story says something, huh? Yeah, big deal. It's not like he's ever been proven right before, so make sure to ignore that. All right. And, you know, what does Iran really do when they say Iran is spreading their empire? Our guest, Salani Kolhatkar, mentioned how actually Iran tried to stop the Houthis from taking Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. And even Obama himself admitted it. The Iranians warned him not to do it. You're biting off more than you can chew. We can't help you. Don't do it. They did it anyway. Oh, yeah, that's the Iranian Empire on the march. What is the Iranian Empire actually up to in the Middle East? Well, George W. Bush and the American consensus handed them Iraq. That wasn't an Iranian invasion. It was an American one. And America fought the civil war on the side of the Shia militias to kick all the Sunnis out of the capital city, which is what got a million people killed during all of that. That wasn't Iranian aggression unless you count just playing a confidence game on George W. Bush aggression, but it's really America's aggression there. And right now what they're doing is helping fight the Islamic State, which is the result of what America did for them, backlashing now in Sunnistan. And their agents Hezbollah and Assad are busy fighting Al-Qaeda in Syria right now. Better stop them, huh?
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And so, yeah, man, well, you know, this shouldn't surprise you. At least 6 killed as Israel continues attacks on Syria. State media reports slain were civilians. Israel insists 5 were terrorists. Despite Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insisting Israel doesn't intend to ratchet up strikes against Syria, his nation continued to attack targets inside Syria today. That's yesterday, the 21st. Oh, no, not the 21st. Jesus, this is already that old. Killing at least 6 people and wounding 7 others. The airstrike hit a car, killing 5 within, and also killed a 6th bystander. The identities of the 5 targets are still in dispute, with the Israeli military claiming they were Islamic Jihad fighters, and Syrian state media insisting they were civilians. Huh. Islamic Jihad. You know, in the past, whenever they had bombed Syria, I mean, in the recent past couple of years, whenever they bombed Syria, it was always regime targets or Hezbollah. Basically flying as Al-Qaeda's air force there, not only as their hospital, but as their air force. But, anyway. The latest string of incidents began on the 20th when stray rocket fire from inside Syria hit an empty field in Israeli-occupied territory. There were no casualties. Israel initially blamed Islamic Jihad, then later said Iran was responsible, then finally declared Syria to be totally responsible, I guess meaning the Syrian government, and confirmed widespread strikes against Syrian military targets yesterday evening. That'd be the 20th. On the 21st, Israel seemed to be rolling back the blame, as now claiming Islamic Jihad was responsible and that everyone responsible was killed. They're still blaming Iran, however, suggesting they ordered the attack and that this should kill the P5+1 nuclear deal with Iran. Wait, Egyptian Islamic Jihad works for Iran now? Huh. Yeah, not so much, I don't think. I guess, I gotta admit, I don't know everything about Islamic Jihad in Syria, but isn't Zawahiri from Egyptian Islamic Jihad? We're supposed to believe they're working for the Ayatollah? Sounds like we got our wires crossed here, dude. And then I like that throwing in. Yeah, by the way, this is why we shouldn't have the nuclear deal. They're worried about what I'm hoping for. That no one will believe the hype anymore after the deal and the expanded inspections. Anyway, Islamic Jihad denied having anything to do with the stray rockets almost immediately, and indeed it doesn't make a lot of sense for anyone to have ordered an attack on an empty field. Stray fire has happened a few times over the course of Syria's civil war, and Israel always used it as an opportunity to attack targets inside Syria, though they also have attacked targets inside Syria on occasion without this pretext. I remember, man, back 3 years ago, probably, or 4 years ago, whenever Israel was first bombing inside Syria, thinking, man, so they're bombing Israeli military weapons depots. I wonder if they're doing that because Hezbollah is going to get their hands on them, like they say, or if it's because the jihadists are going to get their hands on them, and maybe they're worried about a little bit of blowback. But no way, man. Even now, I'm still not cynical enough. Like, they're definitely not keeping them out of the hands of the jihadists. They're perfectly happy to see the jihadists get them. If they're bombing weapons stores up there, it's because Hezbollah was going to get them or the Syrian army was going to use them. And, you know, they admitted this on the front page of the New York Times, I guess 2 or 3 years ago now, in a post by the lady who is now their Jerusalem correspondent. Oh, man, what's her name again? I can picture her face from her byline picture there thing. I'm trying to remember what her name is. Anyway, it was the front page of the New York Times, and she quotes a very high-level minister in Israel saying, yeah, you know, our policy is really just to bleed, you know, to see both sides keep fighting and weaken each other endlessly, keep bleed. He used some, you know, bloody, horrible metaphor for it, too. I forgot exactly. Is that lady's name again? Now that's going to bother me. Hey, Fitzy G, what's the name of the New York Times correspondent in Jerusalem? Ethan Bronner is the guy that she replaced. Right? Something like that. Anyway, they admitted that. And, you know, I even have the clip here for you. I haven't played this in a while. Hey, it might be news to some people. It's certainly important. And that is, if I can find the clip. Yeah, Michael Oren. This was just after he stopped being the Israeli ambassador to the United States explaining to all the fancy pants people at the Aspen Institute thing. And this was just more than a year ago. So it's after the fall of Mosul, after the declaration of the caliphate. This is Michael Oren. You can hear him specifically refer to the Islamic State, not just, oh, the moderate, the mythical moderate fighters in Syria. He refers to their execution of all the Iraqi army guys that they had captured and all that. So he's talking about the Islamic State, and he's still saying Israel prefers them to Assad and to Hezbollah because they're backed by Iran, but only why? Because he pretends that Iran has nuclear capability, military nuclear capability, which is just an outright lie, of course. And then he blames all the casualties on all sides in the Syrian civil war on Assad. That's the other reason. And, you know, I'm not saying I'm pro-Assad or anything, but that's a bunch of crap. So, anyway, here's this. Oh, now play the damn thing. Sometimes I hit the button and it takes a second.
If we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, you know, if someone's got to, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail.
Hey, all right, so thanks to Kit in the chat room, man. I totally spaced out on it. It's Judy Ruderin. Jody Ruderin is her name. I'm so sorry that I spaced and could not remember her name for a moment there. Jody Ruderin, she is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the New York Times. And then I think I found the article right here while dude was blabbing. Pax Limited Strikes, no outcome. Yep, here it is. Israeli officials have consistently made the case that enforcing Obama's narrow red line on Syria is essential to halting the nuclear ambitions of Israel's arch enemy, Iran. More quietly, Israelis have increasingly argued that the best outcome for Syria's 2.5-year-old civil war, at least for the moment, is no outcome. For Jerusalem, meaning Tel Aviv, the status quo, horrific as it may be from a humanitarian perspective, seems preferable to either a victory by Assad's government and his Iranian backers, or a strengthening of rebel groups increasingly dominated by jihadists. This is a playoff, quote, this is a playoff situation in which you need both teams to lose, but at least you don't want one to win. We'll settle for a tie, said Alon Pincus, a former Israeli consul general in New York. Let them both bleed, hemorrhage to death. That's the strategic thinking here. As long as this lingers, there's no real threat from Syria. Now, of course, end quote. Now, the joke, of course, is that there never was a threat from Syria. What threat was there from Syria? And what good has this done for Israel other than give a new generation of Hezbollah fighters battle experience killing Al-Qaeda guys? You know, just because the Israeli government thinks something is a good idea for the country of Israel's long-term interest doesn't make it so. In fact, it's the leading indicator, probably, of what is not a good idea. Really, this is preferable? Hundreds of thousands of refugees, at least a couple of hundred thousand killed on both sides. Al-Qaeda guys, the rise of the Islamic State and the caliphate, the rise of al-Nusra Front, and, you know, them fighting even in Lebanon, reaching toward the Mediterranean Sea. This is better for Israel in the long term? Yeah, if you're a psychopath. Yes, let them all hemorrhage. Over at the International Business Times, they're wondering if Israel's going to invade Syria. Meaning, on Al-Qaeda's side, against Assad and the army.